Ella?
Good morning. May it please the court, Oliver Davis for Christina Bella. May I reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal argument, Your Honor? This is Christina Bella's appeal from a conviction for trafficking in stolen property. And I'd like to just very briefly discuss the first of the evidence rulings, which we believe warrants reversal in this case, and then very quickly move on to the question of the advance restrictions that we believe were wrongly placed on defense counsel's ability to make certain statements to the jury in voir dire and make certain statements in argument, opening and closing argument. This case was a close one. It involved the sharply contested question of whether Ms. Bella knew that the jewelry she sold to a pawn shop in Marysville was actually property that had been stolen from one of her housemates, Ms. Brown. Now, Ms. Brown and a third housemate, Ms. Spencer, had had a very angry and heated argument over the telephone, and Ms. Brown arrived home to find that her room in the house had been ransacked and her expensive jewelry had been taken. Ms. Bella's defense to the trafficking charge, of course, was that she did not know. She had no idea that this jewelry was stolen. She, in fact, and she testified, that she was given the jewelry by the third housemate, Ms. Spencer. Ms. Spencer said to Christina, "This is my jewelry. I need money for rent. Can you please sell this for me at that pawn shop where you've been legally selling property for years?" In that context, it was a reversible error for the court to deny the defense travel funds to bring in Ms. Bella's mother, who I'll call Judy Bella, to fly in for trial tomorrow, requiring no continuance at that point, and for the mother to testify that she was there when Ms. Spencer approached Ms. Bella and said, "This is my jewelry. Christina, will you please sell it for me?" Now, the argument, of course, is that this testimony would have been cumulative. That may well have been an issue at the point at which defense counsel was asking for a significant continuance to bring this witness in. But by the end of the day on argument on that issue, defense counsel concluded that he could bring this witness in tomorrow, requiring no continuance, if he simply was able to be given travel funds for the witness. And the case law suggests or states that travel funds should be provided to an indigent defendant if the witness is necessary for her defense. And in this case, although it is true that there was another witness...
Are you suggesting there's a different test if no continuance is required?
I am.
And what case supports that proposition?
The cases that say, ask about whether a continuance is appropriate rely very heavily on the question of whether the evidence would be cumulative.
What case stands for the proposition that we apply a different test about whether the evidence is cumulative, whether a continuance is required or not?
I don't know that I can cite a case that specifically compares and contrasts those two different situations.
Why would we apply a different test for the cumulative evidence question if a continuance is required?
Because the right to present a defense when that does not require a significant continuance is simply assessed on the basis of whether the evidence is relevant, and on the other hand, whether it is so prejudicial that its interjection into the trial would prejudice the truth-finding process, the fact-finding process.
What does the record tell us about the difference in cost of bringing this witness up the next day versus if the request had come earlier?
I don't believe that the record shows that
My common experience is, unless I'm flying standby, when I want a ticket to go someplace tomorrow, it costs significantly more than if I tried to buy that ticket earlier.
I think that's absolutely true. I don't recall that the court's conclusion was based on the difference between a ticket purchased for travel the next day and one requested earlier.
Okay. The court's ruling... You wanted to get some other issues in...
Yes. So... this is, I think, an issue of first impression. It seems to me to be quite unusual that the prosecution would be allowed to place essentially a prior restraint, advance restrictions on turns of phrase that defense counsel is permitted to use in introducing the case to the jury and in arguing the case to the jury. When the court introduced the case to the jury veneer, the court said this is a criminal case, the charge is trafficking. Of course, the defendant is presumed innocent, and that presumption lasts until such time if and until she is found guilty. The prosecutor appropriately stood up and introduced herself to the jury by saying, I represent the charging party, in this case, the state of Washington. But Ms. Bella's trial counsel was prevented from saying, I am the defense attorney in this case, and I have the privilege of representing an innocent person.
Would it have been objectionable if the prosecutor got up and said, I represent the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, who has a record of never arresting an innocent person?
That absolutely would have been appropriate, but it's inappropriate, but it's not comparable.
How's it different?
It's not comparable to what occurred here, because defense counsel was not offering a personal opinion about this defendant in this case. Defense counsel was making a statement that is true in every criminal case. It was simply his rhetorical flourish, his way of saying, this is a criminal case, and this defendant stands before you as an innocent person until such time as you may find her guilty. That is always true. She's presumed to be innocent, therefore she is innocent unless you find her guilty. And in fact, the defense went on later during voir dire, as counsel often does in voir dire, by asking the jury about the presumption of innocence. Do you understand what that means? Do you understand that it lasts through to the end of your deliberation?
Why isn't that sufficient to protect the defendant?
I think the question of whether what defense counsel was able to state later might go to the question of harmlessness. But I do believe, Your Honor, that
this is a question we would have to address.
Because there's something inherently problematic about the trial court placing advance restrictions on a turn of phrase that defense counsel might use in voir dire or opening statement and closing argument, because
don't judges do that all of the time in motions in limine, tell people they can't talk about certain things, can't say certain things?
Well, you know, I would actually say that defense counsel, trial courts often encounter motions in limine from defense counsel in which the motion is motion in limine to prevent the prosecutor from appealing to the passion and prejudice of the jury, or motion in limine to prevent the prosecutor from commenting on guilt. And I certainly don't fault defense counsel for bringing those motions, but in 99% of the instances, the court's response is to say to defense counsel, you know, counsel, if you believe that the prosecutor says something in opening or in closing that is improper, you object then, because it's only in context that one can determine whether it's inappropriate. This advance restriction on something that is at worst arguable was improper.
May it please the court, I'm Seth Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County. I'm standing in for Kathy Weber, who has been ill the last few days, representing the respondent, the state of Washington. There have been several issues addressed in the brief, but two issues raised in argument today, and I'll focus on those unless the court has questions about the others. The first question has to do with the denial of a last-minute, literally morning-of-trial request for travel funds for an out-of-state witness. Now, the defendant obviously has a right to present witnesses on his behalf, but that right is not self-executing. That is, the defendant cannot sit there doing nothing and say, God, bring in the witnesses on my behalf. The defense has to identify the witness and make timely request for appropriate process or procedure for the court to bring the witnesses into the court. Otherwise, it's not going to happen. And as for the
are you suggesting there's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim here that we haven't had presented to us?
That's a possibility. It would depend on
what factor went into counsel and what decisions they made. And there is a peculiar circumstance in this case with counsel claiming that he didn't know about the witness until the Friday before trial, when the witness was evidently known to the defendant, you know, herself, any time since the case was charged. Now, you know, how did that late knowledge come about? We don't actually know. Is it that he never bothered to ask who other witnesses, what other people might have been present? That could raise an ineffective issue. Or did his client suddenly remember at the last moment that there was another person present? That would not raise an ineffectiveness issue. So, yeah, it's possible that there's an ineffectiveness issue here, but it's one that, of course, has not been raised and could not be determined from the record. What we have on the record is a witness that was clearly known to the defendant at every time since the charges were filed, a witness that apparently for unknown reasons was not disclosed to counsel until the Friday before trial, with no explanation for that.
What do you have to say about counsel suggesting that there's some kind of a sliding scale that we would use depending on whether a continuance is required or not?
Well, I would have to say that that's a factor that enters into the court's discretion. The court obviously has discretion whether or not to grant a continuance and whether or not whether or not to grant a last-minute request for travel funds. I mean, I would suggest that, you know, probably if no delay is going to be required in the trial, that would be a factor that the court could take into account and would weigh in favor of granting the request. Now, if this witness was needed travel funds from Tacoma instead of California, the exercise of the court's discretion might have been different. This court, of course, has to look at the big picture, and the ultimate question is whether there was an abuse of discretion given the lateness of the request and given the cumulative nature of the evidence. There was none. This was not the absence of a witness who prevented the defense from putting on a defense. Rather, they had the same defense, and there were simply two witnesses, that is, the defendant and her niece, rather than three to testify to the relevant facts. One other point I'd like to make in connection with this, that is, the appellant's brief talks about what actually happened during cross-examination of the niece. Obviously, that is not a fact that could have influenced the court's exercise of discretion in deciding at the beginning of trial whether to grant the request. The court didn't know what was going to happen during cross-examination. If that was a key factor that the court should have taken into account, then a motion for a recess or some similar motion should have been renewed mid-trial, and it was not. The second issue that's been raised is preventing defense counsel from saying during voir dire that he had the privilege of representing an innocent person. In context, that is clearly would come across to the jury as an expression of personal opinion. It is no different than the prosecutor commencing the case by introducing herself saying, "I have the privilege of prosecuting a guilty person." Now, my client is innocent in argument in the context of a discussion of the facts could be.
What if instead the offered opening line is, as a defense lawyer, I always represent an innocent person at the start of a trial?
That might be permissible, since it's closer to the edge. Jury might think, yeah, well, this lawyer only picks innocent clients like Perry Mason, or the jury might think he's talking about presumption of innocence. The clearest way to express the idea, of course, is to talk about the presumption of innocence, which this court specifically allowed defense counsel to do. He was entirely free to say, I represent a client who is presumed to be innocent.
So where do we draw the line? I mean, that's what this case is about.
Well, to begin with, we have to recognize that we are talking here about counsel introducing himself. This is not a limitation on argument. An introduction is not supposed to be the beginning of arguing the case. It's to tell the jury, this is me and this is my client, who the people are involved. So,
well, if it really didn't matter because it's a preliminary thing, what on earth possessed the state to make the motion to exclude the kind of statement?
Because the statement, I have the privilege of representing an innocent person, strongly conveys to the jury, I believe this client is innocent. Why else is it a privilege to defend her? I mean, is it a privilege?
What caused the anticipation that that was going to be stated, or is that happening now just routinely?
There's an indication in counsel's argument, in the prosecutor's argument, that this particular defense attorney routinely used that phrase in introducing himself to the jury, which is why the motion in limine is brought. You know, where is the line to be drawn? The line is to be drawn between between statements that sound like counsel belief and recognition of the rule of law. Presumption of innocence is a rule of law that applies in every case. Factual innocence, that is, innocence without modification, is a fact. It exists in some case and does not exist in others, and is ultimately for the jury to decide. You know, it's I've sometimes smiled when I hear the, you know, in the television program they introducing the case by saying all suspects are innocent until proven guilty in a court of law. So no guilty person is ever charged. Every person that's charged is innocent. And the state proves that they're guilty. And, you know, it's really hard to prove that an innocent person is guilty. It happens sometimes, but it's rare. And then they're magically transformed into a guilty person. But no, that's not what happens. A person is factually guilty or factually innocent, a historical fact which is always true or not true and never changes. It's just sometimes we can't tell what's wrong.
Thing, is that really true? I mean, someone may have committed the act that is the crime, but being guilty is a status that requires a legal determination, and that usually requires a trial or a plea.
I mean, you know, we talk about a miscarriage.
We're really getting to angels on the head of a pin when we start talking that way, aren't we?
Well, you know, I guess we're all back to the old tree falls in the forest conundrum. Does it make a sound? I think in law, the answer is yes. Facts are facts, and courts try to determine what they are, and often we succeed, sometimes we fail.
Well, you would concede, would you not, that some people have actually committed a crime but are not found guilty?
That's correct, and I would say the reality is that those are guilty people who manage to obtain a verdict of not guilty, which, of course, does not, even not guilty, is not synonymous with innocent. A person can be guilty and the state fails to prove it, and therefore they are declared to be not guilty. You'll notice that this attorney used the phrase innocent and meant that deliberately. Innocent, strictly speaking, innocence isn't what the jury is called on to determine. They're called on to determine, did the state prove that this defendant is guilty? A person can be guilty and yet not prove guilty, just as occasionally an innocent person can be proved and declared legally guilty. This was a proper attempt by the court to prevent what would clearly have come across as an expression of personal opinion. The judgment should be affirmed.
Your Honor's penetrating questions about this issue really illustrate the problem. Do you really want these questions to have to be debated before every opening statement and every voir dire session that happens in a criminal case? Your Honor asked about why this has been raised. I can tell the court that there are a number of cases bubbling up in the system in which the prosecutor is now making a habit of saying, prevent defense counsel from using this turn of phrase or that turn of phrase in advance, in opening statement, closing argument, and the like.
Are they all riffs on this same, I represent an innocent person, or the other kinds of issues?
They're riffs on that same theme, and the thing is, it depends upon context, right? One could say essentially these same words, and it could be entirely improper. I am the defense attorney, and in this case, I represent an innocent defendant.
Why do we care what you think?
That
was that's an expression of opinion.
If I were to phrase it that way, that would be improper. But as counsel was, as the words are on paper, and that's all the court can look at in advance for an in limine ruling, counsel was simply stating something that is true under the law. Now, the jury instructions say that in jury instruction number one, that she's presumed innocent. So therefore, she is innocent until she's proven guilty. That's all counsel was saying. The objection appeared to be...
Counsel could have said, I represent a presumptively innocent person. Now, he wouldn't want to say that because it doesn't have the same impact to the audience.
He said that very thing later. He used presumption of innocence and innocence. It's simply a rhetorical flourish. And in advance to say, defense counsel cannot touch on this topic, cannot phrase this a certain way, is something that chills the ability of defense counsel to argue for his client. Now, Mr. Fine said something that needs to be pointed out. It is not the same thing to say, I am the prosecutor and I am prosecuting a guilty man. That is legally untrue. Defense counsel stating they represent a person who's innocent is legally correct. I'd ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.